putting the customer or the woman ahead of our product, that's something that's, you know, been inherent to us from the very beginning, even as we, you know, thought about pricing strategies and eliminating the pink tax. It wasn't about trying to make as much money or sell at all costs. It was very much about how do we prioritize this customer? How do we, you know, put women first in a category that hasn't really done that?
Hey everyone, welcome back and thank you for joining us for the season 4 premiere of The 2%, a podcast highlighting women who are breaking barriers and building the businesses of the future. I'm your host, Anu Dugal, founding partner of Female Founders Fund, the largest seed fund for female-founded companies. I'm thrilled to kick off season 4 with today's guest, the incredible Georgie Gooley of Billy, the leading female shaving and body brand company. I first met Georgie in 2017, 2 weeks prior to Billy's launch. Her work in brand building and product development for the Billy launch was incredibly impressive, and Female Founders Fund very quickly moved to lead Billy's seed round several weeks post-launch. So much has happened in the 5 years since, including 2 acquisition offers, several viral campaigns, and a pink tax rebate. I'm excited to dive into it all. Let's get started.
Hey, Georgie. So great to have you on here today. Let's start with, how is your day going?
My day is going well. It's been busy. It's been an exciting time for Billy because we have been rolling out our national Walmart launch. So every day, you know, just focusing on, you know, how are we rolling out in the 4,000 stores, checking in. The team is, you know, laser focused on making sure that we're executing in store. It's our first foray into retail. So that's what we've been doing today.
Amazing, amazing. So I guess, you know, just to take a step back, you know, before starting Billy, I know you'd worked in the agency world globally. So New York, Sydney, Portland, on accounts like Old Spice, PlayStation, McDonald's, at one of the leading agencies in the world. Where did you first discover this passion for branding and storytelling?
Yeah, it's a interesting start, I think. So I grew up in Indonesia. My dad's Australian, my mom's Indonesian. I spent half my years growing up in Indonesia. And I was actually in a few advertisements as a teenager. And so it was actually being on set for those ads. I was really drawn to, you know, the making of them and the whole process and how things went from concept to storyboards and, you know, the actual production and how it all came to life. And I think that's really where I got the first exposure into advertising and branding. And then those experiences led me to study media and communications at university, follow my path into agency world, and that opened up that world of advertising and branding.
Amazing, amazing. I love that. What do you feel like, you know, obviously you've had a really accomplished career within the industry. What would you say are the biggest lessons and skills that you were really able to bring from that career experience into starting and building Billy?
Yeah, I think working in advertising taught me the fundamentals of what it takes to build a brand that connects with customers. You know, you learn having a sound insight, having strategy is super important, to never underestimate what a killer idea can do for a business. And I think at the end of the day, you know, the biggest lesson from my career in advertising is acknowledging that most people don't care what brands have to say. So you really have to give them a reason to care.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What, you know, so maybe tying it back to Billy itself, what was the inspiration, you know, behind it? And maybe tell us a little bit about the founding story.
Yeah. So I think, you know, when I met Jason, we obviously had seen that there was activity in the men's razor space. So I thought there was an obvious business opportunity on the women's side because no one was really tackling that. But what I was really excited to do was create a brand that would really challenge the category and bring a fresh perspective. and hopefully create something that people would really care about in the same way I did. And so looking at the category, you know, it was very dominated by these men's brands. The way women were depicted, the way they were spoken to, it just didn't speak to me as a person. And I thought, if it didn't work for me, it's probably not working for a lot of other women out there. And I think we saw that as one, just, you know, this is ripe for course correction. And also there's a brand opportunity here to really come in and put women first in a category that had always thought of them as an afterthought.
Yeah, no, I love that. In terms of, I guess, leading into that, you know, how would you describe Billy? What is it that's really unique and special, you know, compared to some of the other razor and body brands out there?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, Billy as a brand, it exists to champion womankind. And as a company, we've always prioritized this authentic connection we have with our customer. Even at times, we've done it at the expense of, you know, promoting our product. And I think a good example of that is, you know, 6 months into launch, we launched Project Body Hair. And with that campaign, we were the first razor brand, I suppose, to show women shaving actual body hair, to say that shaving is a choice and not an expectation, and really, you know, do whatever you want to do with your own hair. And that seems very, you know, that might seem counterintuitive for a company that's, you know, just 6 months old and trying to sell some razors. but we had always thought of ourselves as, you know, first and foremost, a brand that champions women. We just happen to sell razors. And so putting the customer or the woman ahead of our product, that's something that's, you know, been inherent to us from the very beginning, even as we, you know, thought about pricing strategies and eliminating the pink tax. It wasn't about trying to make as much money or sell at all costs. It was very much about how do we prioritize this customer? How do we, you know, put women first in a category that hasn't really done that. And if we can have that connection, then we can build that trust. And if you want to shave, great. If you don't, we have other products as well, but we're not forcing any idea onto our customers.
Sure. No, that makes complete sense. And, you know, I think, as you said, the messaging and the brand voice is incredibly important, and I think has really resonated with millions of women. I would love to maybe also hear how you thought about product disruption. So, you know, here you have an opportunity to just rethink, you know, everything related to razors. And so when you think about kind of surprise, the surprise and delight factor, particularly for, you know, a product like razors, what was the strategy?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the challenges we had set for ourselves was how do you make shaving, which is, you know, honestly not the most fun thing out of your, you know, beauty routine. How do you make that exciting and fun? And how can you get people to be excited about, you know, getting a razor in the mail and shaving for the first time? And so really everything that we do, we like to say, you know, we're bringing innovation, fair pricing, and a little bit of magic to everyday routines. And so really, you know, from the very beginning, we sought input from customers from day one. So, you know, had input from women. What do you like about shaving? What do you hate about shaving? Like, what can we do to make things better? What would you like to see? And really understand, you know, how women were shaving, what was the context, and what could we build that would improve that routine for them. And that was everything from designing our own handle so that it fits within your hand when you're shaving in the shower, that you have this aloe shave soap completely surrounding the blades so that, you know, you're not relying just on shave cream, which washes down your leg when you're in the shower. You have that lubrication. We heard that women, you know, often throw their razor in the corner and it gets goopy and it gets rusty. And so we created a magnetic holder so that you could easily store your razor without a suction cup because they always fall down. So all of those insights and input from customers really helped design the Razor starter kit that we did. And then we thought about packaging, like how can we just make this? How can we have fun colors? How can we make it the unboxing experience really great? You know, we think our brand is every touch point you see of Billy. So it's everything from, you know, if you find us on Instagram and you go to our website and then you have your whole checkout experience and the email you get after that, and then the physical product. So really thinking about the whole brand experience holistically, right up until, you know, the actual usage. And so that's really where we try to infuse and wherever we can, that element of delight into sort of an everyday mundane routine.
That's great. And I guess, you know, you had referred to this a little bit earlier, the pink tax.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's an important part of how you guys wanted to really tackle some of the issues related to kind of the discrepancy in the razor industry. Do you want to share a little bit more about that and how you guys addressed it?
Yeah. So the pink tax, it's really a pricing strategy that's used across industries to charge more for products or services that are targeted towards women. And so this can be found across, you know, it's everything from, you know, shampoo, clothes, dry cleaning, and it's typically a 10 to 15% premium. And I was really familiar with the pink tax, and I was actually buying men's razors because I didn't want to be charged for this pink tax. I'm just out of principle, right? Mm-hmm. And as I was doing my research into more of the shaving category and understanding the pain points, this kept coming up, that men's razors were cheaper, and that's why, and they work, so why not use that? And so when we launched, we knew our pricing strategy was super simple. It was, what are the men's charging for a comparable, you know, blade? And that's where we'll be priced. So that was the easy part. But what we really wanted to do was raise awareness about the pink tax. And when we launched with this program called the Pink Tax Rebate. And that was really an awareness play. We said, you know, help us raise awareness that the pink tax exists. And we'll give you credit, or we said like dollars back for all those years you've spent over paying for pink razors. And that was, you know, really part of, you know, again, laddering up to our mission as a brand that champions womankind, but tackling it from all sorts of, you know, all sorts of places. And the pink tax was one of them.
Amazing. I love that story. So, you know, to the point you made earlier, Billy has now become much more than just a body brand. It's a platform to drive social change, to empower women. What and how really shaped that narrative?
Yeah, I think, you know, at the beginning, this came from a very intuitive place for me. It was really just taking stock of how the shaving category was showcasing women, how they were talking to them, and it definitely wasn't resonating for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that was really the moment where I was like, well, if it's not working for me, I'm sure it's not working for a lot of other people. And that therein lies that opportunity, right? To create mm-hmm. a brand that really can empower women in an authentic way amongst a sea of men's brands.
Yeah.
And I think that's how, you know, it's when we were launching, it's the brand market fit and the product market fit. And you know, you want both, right?
Yeah.
And so we worked really hard to make sure that we really understood what customers were looking for in terms of product market fit and how could we improve their daily routines, and then also looking at it from a brand perspective and why aren't the current brands resonating with women and how can we, you know, recreate that and repair the relationship that the category had with women.
Yeah. Going back to kind of the early days from a marketing standpoint, you know, obviously today Facebook and Instagram have become challenging for a lot of D2C brands as it relates to kind of customer acquisition. What worked best? You know, what were some strategies that enabled you to grow at the rate that you did, particularly in the early days?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the early days, obviously being a DTC brand, we've always had a really heavy presence on paid social. And that's historically where we've gained a lot of traction and engagement. It's also a really great way as you're, you know, as you're launching to keep a pulse on the chatter around your brand. So, you know, we would see entire forums being developed on our ads and people giving reviews and debating the content of the ad. And, you know, if we had, you know, chosen to show really impressive body hair, you know, people would have all their thoughts on that. So it's a really great way. It was really a great way for us to like stay very close to the customer and have a really great pulse. But then, as you said, the market landscape and the marketing landscape is shifting. And so, you know, over time, we've really worked hard to diversify our media mix. And so now, you know, we're still on paid social, obviously, but podcasts and TV and YouTube, they're all, you know, a much bigger mix of our media. And PR has also been a really important strategy for us. So always trying to stay top of mind, culturally relevant, make sure that our products are receiving awards and, you know, in the hands of beauty editors. So that's been an important channel for us too.
So you already touched a little bit on Project Body Hair, and you know, within the industry, Billy has become very well known for super inventive and non-traditional marketing campaigns. Think of a woman, Pride Fairy Tales. Could you share just a little bit more about those campaigns? How were they received? Any kind of surprises there?
Yeah. So last year, to celebrate International Women's Day, we launched a campaign called Think of a Woman. And what the intent of that was it was to challenge what people thought when you asked them to think of the perfect woman. And we had done surveys, and we found that most people are still really viewing women in this very one-dimensional, cis-focused lens. And we wanted to challenge that notion and really expand and celebrate the full spectrum of womanhood. And so this was a really great campaign for us. I think prior to Think of a Woman, we had done, you know, a number of campaigns, starting with Project Body Hair, but, you know, a number of campaigns following that really normalized body hair and broke stigmas. And we focused on different body hair parts on a woman. So we had our 4th of July, which really sort of normalized pubic hair. And then we did a Movember campaign where we celebrated women's mustaches. But Think of a Woman was where, you know, we really kind of put a lens on that word woman and wanted to broaden that definition and make it more inclusive and really represent the full spectrum of womanhood. And then following that, not too long afterwards, we had a really fun campaign where we retold classic fairy tales like Snow White, Rapunzel, and Cinderella through an LGBTQ lens. And so this was part of our Pride campaign. But the idea of that was, you know, to make people from the community feel really seen, and also do it in a way that would put a smile on everyone's faces. So that was a lot of fun.
Any surprising reaction?
You know, well, with all of our campaigns, we always get reactions. You know, for the most part, obviously, people are super supportive of our message. And, you know, when we're showing, you know, if we're showing body hair or if we're trying to be more inclusive with the term womankind, or retelling classic fairy tales to be more inclusive, you know, for the most part, we have a large portion of our audience that are super supportive. With anything, you have some people that maybe those views don't align with their personal views, for whatever reason. And so all of our campaigns really do get a great like debate within the commentary, but that's the point. It's the point to bring these topics to the surface and have these conversations. And, you know, we have a brand point of view where we're trying to be as inclusive as possible and, you know, push and empower womankind. But, you know, people on the internet have different opinions sometimes, and they'll voice them. And I think, you know, we always make sure that, you know, our platforms aren't a platform for any negativity or hate speech or anything like that. And what's been really cool is to see, even if you do get some negativity in the comments, you know, for every negative comment, you're getting 100 people sort of backing your message and supporting, you know, what we're trying to do. And so it's really fun to watch in real time, and it's really interesting as well to see, you know, how can a brand play a part in that cultural conversation, and a really important cultural conversation.
And where do you find inspiration?
I think it's important to constantly have your finger on the pulse in terms of the broader cultural conversations that's happening. So, you know, there's great ideas, and then there are great ideas that strike at the right moment. And so I think what we're always trying to do is mine culture to see what's trending, what do people care about, and then where might be a natural fit for Billy to play into those conversations, right? We always want to be relevant. You know, the topics that we enter in are nuanced, and we want to make sure that we're treading those conversations lightly. But I think it's important to, you know, what's happening, what do your audience care about, and then what's natural for you to fit in. You know, there's a lot of things that relate to, you know, womankind and what's going on out there that might not be the right fit for Billy to enter into those conversations. So I think we're always, you know, aware of what's happening, but then also aware of, you know, our brand and our point of view. And you know, sometimes the best thing is not to enter a conversation, right? And other times when it does feel like a natural fit, how do we enter it knowing that, you know, we are a brand, and how can we do that in a way that is, it's, you know, beneficial to our audience that we're speaking to.
Right. No, that makes complete sense. So I guess, you know, originally you guys started with razors, have now expanded over the years into personal care with products like lip balm, dry shampoo, body wash. How do you decide what new products are kind of worth investing in from a development standpoint?
Yeah, so we like to think of Billy as a brand that delivers daily essentials to your everyday routine in an elevated and a playful way. So we're a brand for people who want to be like effortlessly put together. So we like to develop products that help our customers do just that. And the razor, you know, we made it to make a mundane routine more enjoyable. Our lip balm, our dry shampoo, and our wipes, they were designed to help you get up and get out the door or jump on that Zoom looking put together, but with minimal effort. And so that's really kind of the underlying philosophy as we think about product development. It's how do we get that final polished look, but do it in a way where, you know, it's not too time consuming, it's easy to do, and, you know, you can have, it's an enjoyable experience along the way. So right now the team is actually really busy working on a future roadmap of product innovation. So more shave innovation, but also expanding into other body categories as well. So lots more to come here in the coming months.
Exciting. I want to move into the topic of your acquisition, which, you know, was quite a process, as we both know. So I guess rewinding the clock a little bit, you know, January 2020, P&G announces plans to acquire Billy, with ultimately that merger being blocked by the FTC almost, you know, a year later, with concerns that this would be viewed as nascent competition. I can imagine, and I know that this process was not easy. what are you, you know, would love to hear whatever you're comfortable sharing, and also, you know, just any lessons that you took away from this first kind of acquisition process.
So the FTC process is quite a process. I think I would characterize it as lengthy and detailed. So, you know, it's the FTC's job to look at all potential mergers, and then they make an assessment on what impact that merger would have on competition in that category. So that year, what is it, 2020, spent a lot of time with lawyers, learned a lot more about antitrust laws than I could have ever dreamed of. But, you know, and they, you know, they, it's a very laborious process, right? They go through emails, they go through decks, they, you know, they do their due diligence. That's for sure. But I think the biggest takeaway from that experience is creating a company and selling it isn't as easy as it may look from the outside. I think I was surprised, you know, especially we were 4 years old at that time, right? We launched in November of 2017. So, you know, I remember being like, oh, this is like, you know, the government is spending all these resources on little old Billy. but yeah, it was, you know, it was a long process. But I learned a lot, just about antitrust laws and, you know, what they're looking for. But, you know, and then we ended up with the outcome that we did, which is they didn't let that deal go through.
It's an incredibly disappointing outcome. But, you know, fortunately, Billy was able to, you know, obviously work with another great buyer. November of last year, you announced the acquisition by Edgewell. $310 million, incredibly impressive accomplishment for a company that's less than 5 years old, particularly in light of the fact that, you know, there's a merger, a blocked merger, you know, less than a year ago. So what was the thought process around, you know, even re-entering the acquisition process again?
Yeah, I think, you know, coming out of 2020, I mean, obviously we were going through an FTC process and the whole world was going through a pandemic. So it was a really interesting year, I suppose. But really the biggest task for me and Jason at that point was to remain super focused on the business and our team, and just make sure that we were continuing to grow the business and, you know, putting one step in front of the other. And so I think even as we, you know, having the FTC block the first deal, you know, wasn't fun for anyone. But we, you know, had to be disciplined and stay really focused on the, you know, our business and protecting the business and the business at hand. And so as we, you know, as that news came out, we've had a long history with Edgewell. They are actually our blade supplier. So they've been with us from the very beginning. Of Billy. And so, you know, as, you know, that news became public and then we just had a conversation and connected, it came up quite naturally. And I think, you know, having learned what we learned from the last process, we had a higher level of confidence that the FTC would allow this transaction to go through. So again, it was re-engaging lawyers on both sides. And, you know, I think we were cautiously optimistic having had the experience that we had, but definitely there was a sense of optimism that we, you know, this would happen and, you know, Edgewell could be the partner to help us, you know, grow to, you know, to be the household name that we always wanted to be.
In terms of, I guess, the factors that shaped that decision to re-enter the process again, how did you think about it? Was it more reliance on lawyers for kind of their legal view? Was it kind of looking at the precedents of FTC decision-making? Just curious about that too.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it was definitely a combination. We'd obviously had a number of conversations with the FTC throughout the process of the P&G. So, you know, a better understanding of how they were viewing the category. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, we relied on our counsel And we had fantastic counsel that really helped us assess the landscape and the position that we were in. And, you know, both sides, Edgewell and Billy, ultimately decided that, you know, we were going to hold hands and give it a go. And we were, again, we were cautiously optimistic having had the experience, but, you know, you only move forward if you think your chances are higher. and so we did, and, you know, super pleased that we did, because we did have a successful outcome.
Yes. Yes. No, it was an amazing outcome, for you guys, for the team. And also, you know, more broadly speaking, entrepreneurs, you know, great to see, you know, that you're able to build a business that's obviously recognized, but also, you know, has the potential to really change an industry too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's been a wild 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. This February, super exciting news. Billy makes its first brick and mortar debut, launching in 4,000 Walmart stores, first retail partnership. What was the thinking around expansion, you know, outside of D2C?
Yeah, I think, you know, we always had the goal from the very beginning to make Billy a household name. And, you know, we love being a direct-to-consumer business. Again, you can have your pulse, your finger on the pulse in terms of how your customers are viewing you and what the chatter is. But we knew from you know, day one, really, that some people prefer to buy us in store. And so, you know, building the company for 4 years, DTC only, we really felt like now was the right time to enter into retail. And, you know, partnering with Walmart, really, you know, they have, I think we're in 4,600 stores nationwide. I mean, this really is a step in the right direction for making Billy a household name. So super exciting. We have really great, you know, in aisle presence. We have a number of end caps. So really great brand presence in store. And that was really important for us. You know, we're a company that really cares and is precious about how their brand appears. And so that was the same for retail. We wanted to make sure that no matter if you were buying us online or in store, you really got that that Billy magic.
So, you know, you mentioned D2C and kind of the thought process as it relates to expansion. I'd love to get your point of view. You know, how has the D2C landscape changed since Billy launched? And I guess, you know, from your perspective, how do you think it will change in the future?
Yeah, there's been a lot of news on how the e-commerce landscape has changed over the last couple of years. And I think, you know, attribution on the paid social side has changed. So it's been more important than ever to continue diversifying media mixes. You know, social media certainly helped a lot of early direct-to-consumer brands efficiently reach their customers. And I think as the landscape changes, I think we may not have as many companies emerge, but I think the ones that do will need to have an even stronger presence. So I think they'll need to be more disruptive in terms of their product offering or their pricing or their brand. And so I think this shifting landscape is going to make the companies that succeed, it's really more about quality over quantity. That's my early read on the situation. But again, it's, you know, there's a lot in the news. It's a shifting environment. Everyone's learning as, you know, and trying to keep up with the changes. So it's early days, but I think, you know, you know, there's always going to be an appetite for new brands that bring a fresh perspective, a fresh product, better pricing. And so I think it's just a matter of being able to navigate that new landscape and, you know, having a strong offering that people will want.
Yeah. Yeah. And probably I would just add to that, thinking across channel as well.
Absolutely. Yes. Diversifying your media mix is more important than ever.
Yeah. So, you know, we have a number of female founders listening in on this podcast. Would love to just hear your advice particularly for female founders who are looking to explore and navigate the M&A route.
Yeah, I think, one, it's important to find the right home for your business. So take the time to get to know your, you know, the acquirer. You want to make sure that your visions are aligned, that the chemistry is right. And you really need to believe that you'll be able to create something even bigger together. So I think finding the right home is very important. And then in terms of the process of selling the company itself, you know, it's a lot. And especially as a first-time founder, you're learning a lot in real time. So my biggest advice is really surround yourself with people whose advice you trust. And you do need the right team. You need the right team of lawyers and investors. And, you know, if you're working with bankers, you need to feel really comfortable with, you know, the people in that inner circle that are behind you, because you're really leaning on their experience and counsel to make, you know, probably one of the most, you know, one of the most important decisions in your life. And so I would say, you know, keep your inner circle tight, but make sure that they're, you know, really good advice that you're surrounding yourself with.
Yeah, that's so important. I couldn't agree more. I guess along those lines, any advice around when you should start getting to know potential acquirers, or, you know, what worked for you?
Yeah. So we, you know, Jason and I, we were always pretty heads down, very much focused on building the business, but we never said no to, you know, a strategic who reached out and wanted to have a conversation. And we would always have a conversation, even if there was no expectation on either side. But I think having those relationships and making those connections, it's important. And it means that when the right time comes along, there is a natural, you know, potentially an a conversation around acquisition can naturally come up. Right. And so, you know, we had a long-term relationship with Edgewell, obviously. And so, you know, we hadn't discussed acquisitions, but when that time was right, after the news of, you know, the FTC not allowing us to move forward with P&G, that's, you know, because we had that history, that allowed for an open door to have a conversation with them to say, hey, is this something we would want to explore? So I think exploratory conversations should always be had and welcomed. It's great to have. You never know where a conversation can take you. I would say definitely do that. But then, you know, the biggest thing that you can do is build your business and stay focused on the task at hand.
What about community? I know you mentioned, you know, it's really important to have an ecosystem and just generally people that, you know, you trust throughout the founder journey itself. How did you think about creating this community for yourself as a founder and industry leader?
Yeah, I actually have to credit female founders for giving me a really great sense of community and belonging as a founder. I think, you know, as I said, we were heads down. We were really heads down building a company. And when you're doing that, your universe can get quite small. But being a part of this community, where, you know, I had the privilege of meeting other founders and being able to share experiences, and, you know, whether that's in a group setting or one-on-one, with the relationships that you forge there, that's really the community that I've taken away from my 5 years at Billy.
Oh, that's so, I love that.
It's okay.
So I guess to conclude this part of the interview, you know, the 2% is focused on highlighting stories of people who are working to improve, you know, the stats around investing in female founders and diverse founders. From your point of view, what do you think it's going to take to get parity in this field?
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of work to do here, but I think I think every fund and every investor and every founder needs to hold themselves accountable for the part they play in improving equity in this field, right? So I think this is a systemic issue. It won't fix itself. So it really requires each one of us, whether you're, you know, whether you're in charge of the company and building it from scratch, or whether you're looking at your portfolio of investments. And I think it's really on each one of us to do our part and create space for more diversity so that we can have better parity in this field.
Oh, great answer. What is your favorite Billy product?
I'd say the Razor and Cool Blue.
What's the best marketing experiment you've ever been a part of?
Telling people that body hair is natural and beautiful when I'm in the business of selling razors.
What has been the most rewarding moment of your founding journey?
I think it was in those very early days when we started to see that we had established a product market fit and a brand market fit. You know, we'd been building the company for a year, so having that initial validation from customers that we were onto something that could scale was super rewarding.
Finally, where can our listeners find you online?
I'm best on Instagram. My handle's at Georgie Gooley.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Georgie. This was fantastic.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to the 2% for today's episode featuring Georgie Gooley, co-founder of Billy. Georgie is an exceptional branding, product, and people leader, and we are proud to include Billy as a Female Founders Fund portfolio company.
Stay in touch with us on Instagram at Female Founders Fund and on Twitter at FCubeVC. And for those of you building the next billion-dollar businesses, we'd love to hear from you. Send all pitch decks to pitches@femalefoundersfund.com and we'll be in touch. And finally, if you're interested in working at one of our 45-plus female-founded startups, explore our job opportunities at jobs.femalefoundersfund.com. Make sure to subscribe to the 2% on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you are listening. And stay tuned for our next episode with powerful women founding and funding the future. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes or simply tell a friend about the show. That would help us out too. Until next time, I'm Anu Dugal, and this has been the 2%.